screen starts glowing, and the film starts rolling. You wanna be knowing what you might be in for, so give the show a listen. In front of what you're missing, put yourself in position. But the instinct gets your
Hey, listeners, welcome to the 161st episode of The Goods, a film podcast. I like to think that every episode of The Goods is a special episode. That's how I feel. But I think you could argue that the 161st episode is especially special for a few reasons. The first is that it's the end of a theme month. The last five episodes, including this one, have been debut month, where we've talked about the first films by various directors and institutions. And for this last week of debut month, we will be discussing Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs, which is indeed the first film in a lot of different ways, and we'll talk about some of those. It's also a very special episode because we have a guest today, and it's a guest we've never had on the pod before. And this is Hunter Allen, who writes reviews on a website I very much enjoy, and that is Kinemalog, where he has been writing these long and thoughtful and enjoyable reviews for more than 10 years now, I think. So, Hunter, welcome to the pod. Why don't you introduce yourself to us and to the listeners?
Hi. As Dan said, I'm Hunter Allen. I write some, as he notes, long reviews at kinemalog.com. Work as a lawyer. I live in Pennsylvania. I look atrocious with the camera lens.
You look fine.
The phone's camera lens is very disordering. but I've known Dan for a couple years now, I guess, right, Dan?
Yeah, you were one of the first people who started checking out my reviews, commenting on my reviews when I kicked off my own writing adventures on The Goods Film Reviews, which you can find at thegoodsreviews.com, which I started a couple years after I'd been podcasting with Brian. And one of my, like, oh, I made it moments was when you added me to your blog role on the side of your blog. So that was a big moment for me. So thank you, as always, for engaging with me. And I've enjoyed hearing what you have to say always, too.
Well, thank you so much. Yeah, you as well.
And Hunter, I've enjoyed reading your reviews because we tend to agree on a lot of movies.
Oh, really?
Sometimes some deep cuts that I wouldn't necessarily think. But, for instance, you gave a 10 out of 10 to Swiss Army Man. Den sent me that one recently.
Yeah, the masterpiece of fart comedy for all time.
Exactly.
A fartity.
And you recently gave a 10 out of 10 to A Goofy Movie, which, you know, I immediately sent to Brian, and is one of my favorite movies ever. So I was very heartened to see that 10 out of 10.
Oh, yeah, that's... that's a movie that has become a kind of cult classic thing, but really it just sort of needs to, I feel like it needs to extend beyond that. Like, let's just accept that it's actually really good and not just, oh, that's a thing from our childhood that we liked. As I noted in the review, like I watched it in like my mid-20s. I came to it thinking it was going to be trash, and it was not.
I also liked your We're Back, A Dinosaur Story review. Which, while our ratings would not be the same, like, any point that we would have made in a review are the same, which is just that it's a completely batshit movie.
Would your rating be positive because of the batshittery?
I like it because of the batshittery, but also because it features a horror circus, and I feel like I can't be objective about that sort of thing.
It's a supernatural horror circus in a movie about time travel and feeding drugs to dinosaurs.
That's right.
I actually understand. It is one of those movies that you you watch it and you feel alive. You're like, this is an experience. Very unique.
For sure.
So, Hunter, I would say, based on reading your reviews, that you are something of an animation head.
Yeah, not as much as some people we know. I think we can name one person that we all know who is like the animation head. Tim Braden of Alternate Ending, you know, like that guy is, he's a legitimate scholar. He's almost got his PhD in like literally animation history. But, you know, I make an effort.
Right. So Tim Braden, as you mentioned, the critic on Alternate Ending, previously Antagony and Ecstasy, his site was called.
Yeah, right.
He writes terrific reviews on animation. He's got a real great sense of the history and the craft, which is something that I don't quite have. I mean, I kind of thought of myself as an animation head until I started meeting and encountering other animation heads. And I was like, oh, I don't really know all that much about animation, which I think is probably going to come through in this discussion today. Like, I've seen Snow White probably 10 or 15 times in my life, and some of the other Disney movies plenty more times than that. And I got a lot of thoughts about them as films, but less about them as pieces of animation. And sometimes I get a little gun shy bringing things where I feel like I'm in over my head, like I can't say with expertise what I want to say about the film. So that's my caveat to you guys and to the listeners, that we'll do our best here. We'll engage with Snow White, and any bits of context or history you want to throw in here, Hunter, much appreciated.
I'll do my best.
So, debut month, we are talking about Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs. So let's talk about some of the firsts that Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs accomplished. Oh, before we even dive into it, I should say, we're going to do a top five at the end of this episode. We're going to do top five of the 62 movies that are a part of the brand / studio line that is Walt Disney Animation Studio that spans back to 1937 with today's film, if you're counting features. And one thing we can talk a little bit about is, what actually is Walt Disney Animation Studio? Like, is it fair to call it a studio given that it's changed so much over a century, or is it just a brand line at this point? But I guess maybe we can start there, because one of the firsts of Snow White is, indeed, it is the first Walt Disney Animation Studio film, as well as, to my knowledge, the first ever cel animated feature-length film anywhere. You know, if you talk to someone on the street, they might say the first animated film ever. Definitely not true. We've talked about earlier ones on this pod. We talked about Prince Ahmed. Is that what it's called?
It was like 1926 or something.
And then I know that there is like a couple of lost ones from earlier than that, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, from an Argentine animator. I actually forget his name. I forget what they're called. But yeah, I think they post-date The Adventures of Prince Ahmed, but they're from like roughly 1929 or 1930.
Okay.
Yeah, they're lost to history, unfortunately.
But am I wrong, or was Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs the first ever cel animated feature-length film?
That's what I've always heard.
I believe that's true.
Okay, great. And the directing credit on Letterboxd, IMDb, Wikipedia is David Hand, which, again, if you were to ask someone off the street who directed Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs, you probably wouldn't hear David Hand as the answer to that. But this is the brainchild of Walt Disney. Ever heard of him, Brian?
Couple times, especially this week.
And yeah, I'm excited to hear it. When we were doing our top five, Brian said he was going to binge some of the Walt Disney Animation Studio movies he hadn't seen. So I'm curious to hear what he's been up to this week. So Snow White, first animated, first cel animated, first Walt Disney Animated Studios film. Technically, I guess the first accredited to David Hand as director. I don't think that's how most people think of Snow White, as the first David Hand film.
Well, something I found interesting was that David Hand is credited as the supervising director, and then there's like four or five guys listed as segment directors. So I don't even know how that all works. It seems complicated.
So my understanding is that, as to your point, it is complicated. So sometimes characters are supervised by specific directors slash animators, and sometimes also segments are supervised. Do you have any insight on the distinction between like a segment animator slash director and a character animator slash director, Hunter?
My understanding is that Snow White was sort of built modularly, in a modular fashion. I mean, and all animated features are, of course. I mean, really, all live action features are built in a modular fashion, really. But specifically animated features, like the segment directors would be working on a segment, and that would be roughly, you know, 7 minutes, 8 minutes, perhaps, like roughly equivalent to directing an animated short film like Flowers and Trees or The Old Mill or what have you, all those sorts of Disney shorts that led up to Snow White. And David Hand, his job was just to coordinate between those, which is roughly equivalent to what, at least as late as the Renaissance, what the directors were doing, is that they were organizing all these things, serving as like traffic managers to make sure everything melded into a seamless package.
So when we see his name credited as the supervising director, we shouldn't take that to mean that he was doing a lot of like actual animation himself, but he was kind of he was the big picture coordinator, keeping everything rolling.
Typically the directors would not be animating things themselves, although they might, they would be sort of like Walt Disney at the top. People would present work and they would sign off on it, or they'd give them notes and tell them redo this or do it this way. You know, they give them direction, and then when they came back, give them more direction. Yeah, and Sleeping Beauty actually is one of the few, for a really long time, animated features that has finished animation just straight up cut from it. It's some sort of dance sequence with the dwarfs that just Walt Disney just got rid of it.
Wow.
Because it was slowing down the movie, which is interesting considering that Snow White is sort of a hangout movie in the first place.
Yeah, I think you see that modular design where they're kind of feeling it out. Like, how do we take what had previously been a form strictly for shorts and make that into feature length? And parts of it feel like a continuous narrative, and parts of it feel like, oh, hey, we're going to like just chill for 5 minutes in essentially like a short. Like the dwarfs are washing their hands and now they're singing a song and dancing before bed and stuff. Yeah. So I think it goes pretty much without saying that Snow White was like an arduous, risky gamble of a production that took years and years to make, and was something that in the animation industry was unprecedented, particularly the Hollywood short churning out industry. So it's one of those movies that people point to. He took a big swing and the swing paid off, you know, like it made a ridiculous amount of money relative to the time. You adjust it for inflation and it still shows up as one of the all time box office hits, you know. I was wondering, how many movies do you think more people have seen than Snow White? Like Wizard of Oz, maybe? I don't know if the population has grown so much that like the movies now would be seen more than Snow White has been over the years.
Yeah, I was going to think like Avatar, maybe, just because of the much larger global population. And the, you know, rise of film markets in places that previously didn't have as significant ones. But yes, Snow White's got to be up there in one of the highest seen films of all time.
Maybe Star Wars pretty high. But yeah, I think Wizard of Oz is a contender.
And then there's all the home video. Yeah, like who knows? It could be literally upwards of like 3 billion people have seen it over, maybe more, over the course of its lifetime. It is an 85-year-old film, 87-year-old.
And it's had multiple lives because, of course, it had its original theatrical release. It's had a bunch of re-releases, and then obviously a monster on the home video market. Now it's on Disney Plus, you know, streaming. So,
and, of course, soon we'll have our live-action remake.
Yeah, with Rachel Zegler, or whatever her name is. Is she good in West Side Story?
I mean, within the limits of the character of Maria, yeah.
I thought it was well done. I liked that movie.
I'm not holding out hope for the live action remake of this. I picked Pinocchio as the worst movie of 2022. So as part of debut month, we have ourselves a handful of questions that we ask ourselves. So what is this studio best known for, and what is our experience with them? Maybe now is where we can talk about what Walt Disney Animation Studio actually is, and like what it means to be inducted into one of them. So, dumb question, what is Walt Disney Animation Studio?
A company founded in the early 1920s by Walt and Roy Disney that made cartoons and then became an adjunct to theme park empire.
Yeah, I think it's kind of interesting that they've really hyped up in the past year their 100th anniversary, while Snow White came out in 1937. So that was already 15 years into the game. But before then, I mean, early on, like 1922, they had the Alice comedies, which was already experimenting with combining live action and animation. And then they had the Silly Symphonies, which were a variety of shorts that often featured music. I mean, even the, like, the Merry Melodies and the Looney Tunes, it's all part of this trend of doing these animated musical shorts from various studios.
Yeah, I've always been struck by, like, the number of cartoon lines that essentially rip off the name of Silly Symphonies. It's, like, not even just Merry Melodies and Looney Tunes. There's, like, 5 or 6 of them, like, maybe fully 10 that use that sort of like silly symphony, like something, adjective, musical, noun.
Yeah, something that implies comedy, something that implies music.
Yeah. They were, you know, very influential in that respect, I guess.
So listeners, if you think of the concept of a Disney movie, you are almost certainly thinking of the 62 movies in this line, the studio's history, dating back to 1937. Although notably, Goofy Movie not in the Walt Disney Animation Studio line because it was done by a secondary studio, which is where I start to get kind of confused.
Right, and if you're thinking Toy Story, that's out.
Right, now yeah, Pixar's relationship with Disney is a whole can of worms too, because they did some of the CGI in the Renaissance era, right? But then subsequently, they also made their own movies that were, what, were they released by Disney? Like, was Toy Story affiliated with Disney upon its original release?
Yeah, Disney did distribution.
Okay.
Yeah, they partially funded it. I believe Jeffrey Katzenberg permitted some level of production budget from Walt Disney Studios toward the creation of Toy Story, but it was, like, relatively small. It wasn't the whole budget. But, yeah, then Buena Vista, I believe they're still Buena Vista at that point, handled distribution.
And now that you mentioned Buena Vista, I mean, Disney has a whole, like, in-house stable of different studio labels. Like, they've got Touchstone Pictures, which I don't know that gets used anymore. But, like, up through the 90s, at least, it's, like, put out the things that aren't as family-friendly or that we're just not as confident in, label it Touchstone, but it's still coming out of Disney. They've got all their live action stuff.
Yeah, there was Touchstone. Then Michael Eisner created Hollywood Pictures, which is basically the same thing, except he created it. Ron Miller was Touchstone's creature of Ron Miller.
Like, I think even The Sixth Sense was distributed by one of those shell companies, which is surprising.
Yeah, no, I guess it goes back to Walt Disney kind of hedging his bets in 1950 on Cinderella, which was a kind of make or break for the animation studio. The same year, they also released Treasure Island, which is their first full-length live-action film, although they'd done a couple prior to that, Song of the South, and one in 1948 as well. They were animation and live-action hybrids. And if I don't know, that's kind of a what-if scenario right there. If, like, Cinderella had not done well, and this is getting way off of Snow White, but if Cinderella hadn't done well, like, Disney probably would have just been a live-action film studio from then on.
And I believe that one other that you mentioned was that Summer Magic with Burl Ives. The one in between. I think that was the one you're thinking of.
It's something, something heart.
Oh, right, right. Let's see.
So is the animation studio been running continuously since the 20s?
Yeah, since 24 or so, 25. Yeah, I mean, obviously with like significant changes in leadership and ownership.
Not to mention technology.
Stopped being a family company in 1984, yeah. Oh, yeah, as well as technology. Yeah, you mentioned Pixar. Yeah, Pixar developed the CAP system, which is the digital ink and paint system that they used in the 90s. That's a Pixar invention.
Oh, wow.
So like every movie, every movie from The Rescuers Down Under through Home on the Range was digitally inked and painted using an iteration of Pixar technology. To the best of my knowledge, that was all. Like, you had Deep Canvas later in the 90s, but that doesn't replace the actual like CAPS foundational system.
Deep Canvas, didn't Tarzan have some Deep Canvas in it, or was that not until?
Tarzan was the first Deep Canvas film. It allowed for computer-generated backdrops, more or less like 3D paintings is the easiest way to describe it.
Gotcha.
Yeah, I actually just watched Tarzan the other day. I had forgotten how like wild it is to watch a movie like that.
Yeah.
Where it's like it's using computers, but it's still using hand-drawn animation, and it's pretty incredible. The freedom that gives the animators who are actually working on the character animation to just use all sorts of camera angles around Tarzan and all those figures.
It really is a marvel. Another thing I think is important about Walt Disney Animation Studios is that they have maintained a sort of brand integrity, I guess, where you kind of expect their movies to be good.
Do we?
Now, obviously that ebbs and flows.
Yeah. I would say so.
Yeah, maybe not so much that you expect it to be good, but you expect a certain quality to it. I suppose family friendliness, all ages appropriate. And I think now is when I will say that I have now caught up with all of them. All 63. I watched the 14 that I hadn't seen yet over like the past 4 days.
Wait, are we up to 62 or 63?
62. I think you're right, 62. But 14 that I watched for the first time in the last couple days. And in all of them, like, I think that holds true. All of them, the animation is fairly good. Fairly good to incredible. So they're like flexing their animation muscles most of the time. And I think that's the consistent mark of Disney. But obviously, yes, highs and lows over the course of the corpus.
It's pretty impressive that you've seen all 62. I counted, and I'm missing 15 of the 62, and none of the 15 do I get the sense that they would push for my top five. So I didn't feel the urge to binge them prior to this episode. But what about you, Hunter? Out of the 62, are you 62 for 62 or somewhere short of that?
I'm very slightly short of it. There are three I haven't seen. Dinosaur from 2000, I believe, as well as Chicken Little and Meet the Robinsons. I don't think they would hit my top five. I don't know. You never know. But I don't hear a lot of great things about any of those, really.
Right. Definitely towards the lower end. I liked Meet the Robinsons, but those all three of them pretty low.
That is the one that I feel like could be good. I'm almost certain like Chicken Little and Dinosaur are not good. Eventually I'm going to watch them and write about them. And I kind of just want to save the surprise for then.
Mm-hmm. For me, the gaps fell in three distinct eras. It was the 1940s package films, the ones from the mid 2000s, like Chicken Little, which lined up with when I was in high school and it wasn't cool to be watching Disney movies. But then starting with Bolt, people were like, oh, these are good again. So you got to go and you got to watch. And I thought, okay.
Yeah, my gaps are the 40s package films. And then randomly three of the ones from the 80s where I think that it was still xerography technology, which to me, like the epitome of the xerography technology was actually the first one, which was the 101 Dalmatians. But when you think of that kind of more sketch-like look from the 60s, 70s, 80s, I think almost all of those are what you would call xerography, which is a specific animation technology.
Sure.
And then a couple from the mid-2000s, early CGI. I also caught up with some that I hadn't seen since I was a kid. And of those 15, like, I have Brother Bear on that list. I think I might have seen it once with my brothers. It's possible I saw Chicken Little. If I did see them, they obviously didn't leave an impression on me, but I'm counting 15 missing. So
we were about at the same amount that we had to fill in. The most recent gap for me was I hadn't seen the four or five newest movies, like starting with Frozen 2, which of course you've got little kids, Dan, which may have contributed to the fact that you had pretty much kept up with those. But now I have seen things like Raya and the Last Dragon and Strange World and everything. I've seen them all.
Wish. Yeah. Name it. You've seen it. Yeah. So, yeah, that does help. I do a movie night with my two daughters every Friday. So I always try to plug in something that we've never seen before. And I like it if it's something that I haven't seen too. And we usually hit most of the big animated releases as soon as they come out on streaming. So if we haven't seen them in theaters.
You haven't seen Wish yet, right, Dan? Or did you? Did you see Wish?
I did see Wish. I haven't written a review of it.
Ah, okay.
I commented on your review, some of my thoughts. I actually looked at that to jog my memory on how I felt about it. I'm up and down on Wish. I think it's not as bad as its reputation, and I also don't think it's good.
I'm actually there with you on that, yeah.
Yeah, I don't know. I felt like it wasn't enough of a concept to hang a whole movie on.
I agree. And it like dares you to find things in it to not like, basically. Like, it's got really bad lyrics, and they're not just bad lyrics, but they like emphasize the stupid lyrics. It's like, why do you keep saying the one stupid lyric over and over again? But
Dan, in this universe, we're all shareholders.
And I think it way overdid the Disney references to the point it felt cheap. If it had just done one or two, it might have felt kind of magical, but I don't know. We're a little off track here. That's all right. I like riffing on this stuff.
Oh, well, we know where the magic mirror comes from now, don't we?
That's true.
Right. I've always wondered. It's preyed in my thoughts ever since I was a little kid.
This marathon and Snow White in particular, it gave me more of an appreciation for Shrek even than I had before. Like Shrek as being a riff on the Disney animation legacy.
Hmm. Well, I'll save some of my thoughts for when we're talking through it. But for me, you know how when we talked about musical biopics and we talked about Walk Hard, basically we're like, yeah, Walk Hard has kind of ruined the traditional classic musical biopic for us. Enchanted has ruined some of the classic Disney princess movies. Maybe not ruined, but like made me roll my eyes at them for how good of a pastiche or parody Enchanted is. I love Enchanted. Have you seen Enchanted, Hunter?
Yeah, I have. I have. I don't have super clear memories of it. I just remember Amy Adams falls into the real world and then things occur, I believe. Possibly romantic, possibly adventurous. I think she's pretty naive.
Some things do occur. Yeah. Yeah, she plays a live-action Disney princess very well.
I think she's surprised rats don't obey her commands. That might happen.
There's a little bit of that kind of humor. So we've mentioned the names of a bunch of animation technologies just kind of as an overview of the long legacy of what Disney has contributed to animation as a whole. They've been a part of pretty much everything. I mean, you know, they get credited even before Snow White, they get credited with important firsts. And I think many of these are like up for debate / credit is given to Disney where they probably don't deserve it. But first sync sound short with Steamboat Willie, they often get credit for. First three-strip Technicolor animation short, that's the Flowers and Trees. And then, of course, here the first feature. But they've been involved with pretty much you know, from the mid 20s onward, every important animation development, they've done something with it. So it is you get a little bit of everything with Disney. The big kind of technological breakthrough right around the time of Snow White is the multi-plane camera, I think it's called, which I watched a lot of classic animation, classic era Disney in the last week to really try and get an eye for the multi-plane. And I'm still not 100% sure I can always pick it out, but I think it's when you're seeing different layers, so you can kind of get like a zoom effect.
It's like parallax. Anytime you're getting the parallax where the foreground and the background are moving at different rates and you're kind of like getting camera movements where you're progressing through the layers of the art, and it's really cool.
Yeah, I believe it made its debut in the Old Mill short, which came out about a month before Snow White, I believe. So yeah, it was quite a new technology for Snow White. So it's kind of amazing they do it so well.
And you get a ton of it in like Pinocchio and Bambi.
Yeah, all throughout until The Little Mermaid, where one of the production anecdotes of The Little Mermaid involves them having to like outsource the multiplane because Disney's multiplane camera had fallen into such disrepair. So that's why there's not a ton of it in The Little Mermaid, because they had to use an outside vendor. And then after that, it's they just use caps. They just use computer Photoshop-like layers to do it.
I'm surprised they were using it that late, that it survived through the xerography stuff. Were they able to do multiplane with like 101 Dalmatians and Aristocats and all that?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, yeah.
I think maybe it's time. We should dive into Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs, talk through its story a little bit, as we often do. So this film opens with a title card, which I was really struck by how much exposition gets cut out and just tossed to the title card. Like, I feel like most movies would show some of this stuff, but it just throws you right in, basically, here. The first real scene is Mirror, Mirror on the Wall, but it's not even like the one where she's the fairest. We jump right into the Snow White being the fairest as the very first actual animated scene that we see. And we learn from this opening title card, Snow White is a princess, but she has a wicked and vain stepmother. I'm going to go through this. I think most people know the story of Snow White, so we don't need to hit every single point, but just to jog your memory a little, she's forced to work as a scullery maid. I was surprised it specified scullery maid. What is a scullery maid? Forgive my ignorance. What is scullery?
I think a scullery is like a kitchen.
Okay.
So she works in the kitchen. She's got to like clean pots and pans and floors and things.
Then we see the evil queen saying, asking if she's the fairest one of all. And of course the mirror says, no, you're not anymore. Struck me at this time that the mirror doesn't actually say that it's Snow White. It's like someone who's got red lips and white skin, but doesn't say it's your stepdaughter. Just that's like immediately the princess's mind goes to the stepdaughter. So I was wondering if there's a possibility of like a variation on this story where it's like the wrong chosen one. You know how like in Harry Potter, there's like the wrong chosen one theory. If there could be something like that with Snow White too, like actually there's a different fairest one in the land.
Actually, someone is even hotter.
Yeah. I think a lot of the decisions the queen makes in this movie don't really serve her ends.
Not a good strategic thinker, you'd say, Brian.
Like, if her whole thing is being the hottest, why does she decide to become a hag in a process which is not apparently reversible, at least of what we see? She says it's a spell, but, like, how easy is this to double back on?
Well, my thought when I saw this, like, do you not have spells that reverse aging, just ones that make you really old?
Yeah, and one of the components of the spell, she says, this will make my clothes black. Like, do you not just have some black clothes?
Yeah.
No. You're a queen. You can probably hire a weaver to get you some black clothes. Yeah.
I mean, at the very least, she's also like twice Snow White's size. She could just kill her. Just stab her. Just stab her to death yourself.
I do admire that this movie doesn't shy away from the darkness, and that the Queen's first decision is to tell the huntsman to go murder Snow White and bring me her heart in this.
Yeah, it's not like, what was the one we talked about, Brian? Korra, The Legend of Korra, the TV show, where the queen has fallen. Like, we've just seen her asphyxiated just off screen, but they don't want to say she was killed.
Right. No euphemisms. Rip out her heart, give it to me in a box, which I will then carry around and show to anybody who asks about it.
Yeah, the box that was made special for the event. Or maybe it wasn't. She just collects hearts.
So now we meet Snow White, and she is like not bothered that she has to do manual labor. She's like very cheerful about it and singing to animals and all this stuff. And I gotta say, I don't really like Snow White. I think she's annoying and like totally unrealistic as a character. Like, we're not too far from like screwball comedies where you could have really, I mean, chronologically in the, you know, the late 30s, I'm just thinking about like where feminist representation was in cinema at this time. Like, it wasn't unheard of to have like interesting, complex characters who are female in movies. And yet she is like the shallowest and most and worst, flattest character of all of like the stereotypical Disney princesses.
Yeah. It is a fairy tale. So I mean, you have to have that essentiality, I guess, but
yeah,
she is like pretty boring. her main contribution to the film is tidying,
cleaning a house.
That seems to be her primary skill, and also telling other people to tidy.
That's right. Got to wash your hands.
She's coordinating their cleanliness.
The thing that bothers me about Snow White is that she's very clearly rotoscoped. And so, like, all the scenes where you're really focusing on her, the animation doesn't look as good to me as the scenes where you get the slightly more cartoon physics characters like the dwarves and the animals. And it's not just Snow White, it's the various human characters. So it's the prince and the queen and the hunter that you can tell, like a Ralph Bakshi movie, that it's like traced over live action footage. And the result is that their like facial features kind of shift around and the colors are like greasy. I don't know. It's odd. Whereas like the way that the dwarves move as a group and like wrestle around and wash dishes, it's always like compelling, and it looks more normal to me because I expect cartoons to not move with the same weight and speed as a real world person. So that the result to me is I look at Snow White and I see like a human wearing a cartoon suit.
I kind of like it personally. I understand where you're coming from. I do feel that there is a mismatch from time to time between Snow White's animation and the dwarf's animation, where they are clearly from a different mentality and a different way of doing things, where the dwarfs being significantly much less constrained by physics and by
head size,
physical head size. Yeah. I have mentioned several times that Dobie's head is so much larger than Snow White's, and they very much want you to notice how much larger his head is than Snow White's in their dance together. It's remarkable that he could not be particularly intelligent and yet have so much brain case.
Oh, he's just got hydrocephaly.
Maybe. I think that might actually be where they're going with it. But yeah, it works the least with Snow White. I think it works pretty well with the Evil Queen, with her sort of theatrical movements and the weight of her evil, I suppose, her wickedness. I think it works really well with her. Also, she doesn't really share many scenes with other people.
Right. And she also has like a stately stillness to her at times. Like when it zooms in on the window, when we first see the queen, that's basically a painting. At that point, it's not even animated, but like it kind of represents a sort of like controlled grace that the queen has, I guess.
Yeah, that conceals her chaos and hunger.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I love the Evil Queen. I think she's excellent. I think she's very excellent. But Snow White, yeah, she's got some problems. And her eyes do slosh around quite a bit.
One last thought about Snow White's design is this was a very particular era in women's fashion. And it was the Betty Boop era. And actually, I read that they like recruited one of the head Betty Boop animators to consult on design and female character animation. But like this Clara Bow bobbed hairstyle. Like Snow White, she's the only Disney princess with short hair.
Hmm. I never thought about that, but...
True, yeah.
She pretty much is, yeah. Isn't she?
Yeah, it's already like a little bit out of date even by then. It's very much more like 20s or early 30s than it would be like, I don't know, Irene Dunne in like the late 30s or Vivian Leigh or whoever, you know?
I guess that's true. And she's kind of got like an updo.
Cinderella has short hair, does she? Well, so she has bound hair. Well, they have hair bound up.
Right. When we see her, when she's, it's like shoulder length before she gets it pinned up.
Yeah. Yeah, I guess that doesn't really quite count.
Oh, man, I don't want to open the can of worms of what color is Cinderella's dress, but that's one of my favorite things to talk about. Maybe a different day. But I was wondering, when we first see her doing chores, she's wearing rags, which is part of the thing. But then a minute later, she's wearing a beautiful dress. I guess, like, in her off hours, she can wear a beautiful dress or something. This dress, it's like, to me, in terms of, like, iconic Technicolor costumes, right up there with Dorothy's. I mean, obviously it's drawn, so it's not the same type of costume, but this is really an iconic piece of fashion, honestly. I really like it when she's wearing this dress, which is, of course, most of the movie.
It's a good variety of colors. You got blue and black and red and yellow, but they're not, no one color overwhelms the others, and it doesn't have like a messy effect. It looks good.
Oh, yeah, she's a good design. Good costuming.
We also meet the prince before the attempted murder happens. He just like shows up while Snow White is working, and he like pursues her and she runs inside. So we kind of get a reenactment of a balcony scene. I don't know if that's like specifically a Romeo and Juliet thing or if like a balcony scene is a trope by itself, but we get like a 30-second balcony scene too.
Things in these Disney movies move quickly. None of them are very long.
I know. Like this is 83 minutes long, and probably 50 of those 83 minutes are just vibing with the dwarves in the middle act.
They're all one supper. One evening.
I also noticed this watch through that the music is more constant than I remembered. There's like a lot of little mini songs and they all kind of string together.
Mm-hmm. How do we feel about the music in Snow White?
I don't have particularly saliently negative feelings about it, but I think it's more like a cultural primacy thing that like Hi Ho and Whistle While You Work wind up being like famous as, because they're not, Hi Ho is like fun, but it's also a single lyric song. Whistle While You Work, I would go so far as to say, isn't particularly good. And then there's the other ones, which people don't even recall that I see.
That's what I find the most interesting is there's so many of these small songs and only a few of them have really broken through and endured. But like the song where they're singing about digging for the gems, I like.
We dig, 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 dig. That's like my chain gang song when I'm doing some work. That song's running through my head.
I like all the animation effects they do with the like kaleidoscope effect of the gems and the reflections and the echoes. My favorite, though, is the Dwarves' Silly Song, which is when they have a band and they all play different instruments and they have the dance between Dopey and Snow White. Mm. But Grumpy going ham on that, like, cuckoo clock organ thing is awesome.
Yeah, I want to talk about those in a minute, yeah, because I really like some of those, too. And I like when they do the dance with the dwarves stacked on each other. It's a fun bit of character animation. But the voice actress for Snow White is Adriana Casalotti. I'm not sure I'm saying that right. I think that's probably what it is. And she does this kind of fluttery singing voice that I'm not especially fond of, which to me doesn't make me like either the character much more or feel really warm towards the music. Like the other big one that we haven't said yet is Someday My Prince Will Come. But that's a thing I noticed is in general, like these golden era musicals, the Disney musicals, hit or miss on whether I like the style. But like, maybe it's just because when I grew up, but like once we get to the Renaissance, just the music is so much more enticing to me. I don't know what it is about it.
Howard Ashman and Alan Menken.
Yeah, I guess so. Yeah. But even in Bambi, like it's all this heavenly choir type stuff that just doesn't really stick to me in the same way.
I like April Showers from Bambi. I think that's a cute song. But yeah, I don't listen to it. I don't listen to it by itself.
Oh, man. I love April Showers. We'll come back to April Showers in a little bit. Something that struck me this watch through of Snow White is that first scene when she's like working in the garden and the prince shows up. She sings down into a well and the sound echoes back. And when it does, the water ripples. And like how cool that is.
That, yeah, the water animation in this movie is really something. It's basically futuristic in 1937. I'm not sure that, even though Disney was already pretty good at effects animation, this is some pretty next level stuff for that year. Or even for much later, it still looks great.
Yeah, I mean, even to think that it's in color in 1937, and they're like these lush, vibrant colors. And I appreciated all the lighting and shadow stuff. Like there's a lot of characters walking out from indoors where they're in shadow and into outdoors into the sunlight, and every time that happens you see the, you know, the progression of the shades over them, and it always looks pretty good.
The shadow stuff in this is just out of control good. Some of it is just designing a scene, but like when the huntsman sneaks up on Snow White, we see his shadow before we hear or see anything else from him. And then there's a few other scenes that make use of shadows really well. Definitely for me, that was something that caught my eye watching this time.
Yeah, I really enjoy the part. It's when Dopey is elected to venture forth to confront the monster in their bed with his one little candlelight. Like that's pretty incredible considering like the amount of control over like coloration in the backgrounds. Besides just drop shadows, but like the entire thing is pretty terrific control of lighting for a animated film, especially one made entirely by hand.
Right, because like the proportions shift with the light as he walks and moves the candle. It's really cool.
And you got the like trippy scene where Snow White is running through the woods and, you know, hallucinating all the monsters. Like every root snag is an alligator.
That's where we are chronologically in the story, so I will bring us there. The huntsman obviously does not kill Snow White. He brings a pig's heart to the queen. And then, yeah, Snow White runs off with the knowledge the queen is trying to kill her and stumbles through the woods and has this nightmare vision of basically everything being a monster trying to kill her, which is one of the coolest bits of animation in the film. And, I mean, a very cool segment overall in animation history, I would say. This segment always enraptures me.
Yeah, that's where the multi-plane camera gets its first big workout here. It's the push-ins onto the imagined faces of the evil trees, and which we all knew from Flowers and Trees that they had the capability for that malevolence.
Right, the creepy tree in that one.
Yeah.
And turns out that they're not actually scary things, but nature is nice.
Exceptionally so.
Another thing that struck me, not just with this movie, but I rewatched Fantasia and Bambi in this past week. A lot of nature in early Disney. You don't get it quite the same amount nowadays that you did. And it's kind of cool, I think.
You mean the sort of like princess as a magnet for cute woodland animals? That's, yeah, you don't really see that as often. You see it made fun of in Enchanted. Even Tangled. It's like she has a pet,
right?
Chameleon.
I was more saying like a sort of reverence for nature as an abstract concept, and like spending time hanging out in nature and depicting it as a complex and otherworldly and beautiful thing that we just deserves our attention. Like I feel like, I mean, you get a little bit of that, like Strange World is kind of like riffing on that because it's supposed You're supposed to be in awe of its strange world.
To me, it's showing off, I mean, what they can do with animation, but like demonstrating that animation is a tool for capturing the natural world, and that is like a high watermark of skillful animation, is that you can recreate life in this way. It feels almost like a medieval text, like how you would have in like bestiaries and apothecary books, have all the illustrated depictions of plant life and animal life.
Yeah, no, I agree with all that. That in the 40s, at least in the 30s and 40s and 50s, yeah, Disney was much more concerned with an impressionistic idea of nature, just this majestic forests and majestic deserts and that sort of thing.
And Snow White has survived her encounter with the fearsome woods, and now she is being pulled by the animals towards a small house. And it's she thinks it's a house for children, which is kind of a funny concept, I guess. And she thinks it's just children who live there because there's like a lot of little stuff, but it's everything's messy. So no mom has taken care of this house. Because then what do you do when you wander into a strange, dirty house, but you start cleaning it, of course?
I'm constantly breaking into people's homes and washing their dishes.
If you want to swing by our house and break in and clean it up, that'd be appreciated. And one thing I was thinking about as I was watching this is like, I'm not just going to constantly bag on Snow White. Like, I do cheer for her. I don't want her to die or anything like that. It's not like one of those characters where I love to hate her or anything. But the way that she's depicted, just in terms of like, okay, so first of all, she's supposed to be hot. That's like the inciting incident, is she is like sexually attractive. But then also she kind of has like the demeanor of a child, but she's also kind of like a mom to the dwarfs. She's just kind of serving all these roles that you don't really get a sense of like what her character actually is. So she's kind of mom-like, but she's also the housemaid, and she's just a little bit of everything. And she's the bride at the end of the movie, you know, well, the dead bride, we'll get to that. Before long, she is cleaning the upstairs. So she goes to where the beds are, and she notices the seven beds, and the names on the seven beds are all adjectives. We will know them as the seven dwarfs. And she falls asleep, yeah, working hard cleaning, but she falls asleep on their beds. A little bit of like Goldilocks here. And now we cut to the dwarfs. I think technically we actually cut to the dwarfs before she falls asleep, but we cut to the dwarfs who are working, and I'm with Brian. This mining segment is very fun, and the movie gets like 50% better for me. We're singing Hi Ho and these seven part harmonies, and we've got all the gems, and it's just a lot of effects. They're all cool, and you kind of get a sense of the sprawl of the visual design of this as you see them working there.
Yeah, like when they cross that tree on their way home, the sort of camera pan from left to right, just this enormous tree over this enormous chasm, and the lighting is very well attended, and they're singing their little song.
There's water pouring and stuff.
Water pouring, also a waterfall.
The glittering in the mine, yeah.
I guess they are supposed to be, to some degree, like Nibelungen, maybe? Like related to like, you know, Germanic folkloric creatures who dig around for Rheingold, or no, not Rheingold, but you just gold in the mountains. They don't even care about the gems. They barely care.
This watch, I was thinking about how specifically German a lot is, and watching all the Disney movies, like they always do that, is research the area that they're setting it, and they like work in little nods. But like the way that the Fachwerkhäuser on the dwarf's house, like the crossed wooden beams, is super German. And like even there's like steins in the cupboards with like the faces carved on them. And yeah, definitely German design.
You just alluded to this, Hunter, but one lyric that Brian and I were joking about in a chat offline was during their mining song, they say, "We don't know what we dig for, but we dig, 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 dig." Like, I don't know, maybe like to sell the jewels, like to get money. Like that's your profession.
Hire a housekeeper.
Yeah. And man, they're like, they're getting a lot of gems, dude. Like for one day, they're bringing out like wagons full of these huge gems. You could be making a killing. What are they doing with all the gems? What, like there's not a stash of them at the house.
Like, no. They show it. They show the vault that they keep. And the little joke where Dopey keeps the key just on right next to the vault.
Oh, you're right. Yeah. They toss the bags in there. Yeah.
I think they have this like instinctual compulsion, like dragons, that they have to hoard the wealth.
Okay. So they're like smog. Yeah.
That's why I was saying Nibelungen, like in the Wagner opera and the ancient Teutonic myth cycles and what have you. Like where they just dig through mountains for stuff. Why not? And I don't understand why they own soap if they don't clean that.
They do have readily accessible soap, but we are to believe that they'd never clean. Maybe the soap is just, it's years old. It's just never been used. Who knows?
It came with the house.
So then the dwarfs, they once they get back to the house, I think we enter the hangout movie phase that is the whole middle act of the film where it's just like one night vibing with the dwarfs
and their home invader.
And this is where I could get the sense that it was like shorts stitched together. And I think I even read they had some other ones that they were either planning or maybe have even started animating that they decided to cut. Like there was one about making soup. And I think what's the name of the guy? One of the famous animators who ended up doing a lot of work on Pinocchio had some of his stuff cut. Was it Ward Kimball, I think, maybe?
Okay.
I don't know. But
there's a lot of famous animators in this era.
Yeah, exactly.
Now, I did read that one of them was upset when he got his scene cut and Disney said, don't worry, you'll be a supervisor on the next one. So just hang around. Be cool.
Do we have a power ranking of the dwarfs, like favorites and least favorites? I know Brian's answer. You're a grumpy guy, Brian. I just know it.
I mean, grumpy just is head and shoulders above the others. And what I've come to respect more in over the years is that he kind of has a secondary leadership role. He's like the first mate dwarf. Like, so Doc's at the helm, but Grumpy's always like the opposition leader. He's like, you got to hear from Grumpy for a rebuttal.
For consensus building purposes. Yeah, I don't know who my favorite is. I do know who my least favorite is. It's Doc.
You don't like Doc?
He's very peremptory. No, he's very dictatorial.
I feel like if I were going to battle, Sneezy would be my first choice. That dude can like produce a hurricane. But yeah, I think obviously Grumpy and Dopey have the most interesting designs. And it really did occur to me as I was watching that like the others, they kind of blend together. Like if you're just, they're all in a scene and you see like three of them and it's not Doc and it's not Grumpy and it's not Dopey, you're not necessarily going to know which one you're looking at. Oh, is that bashful or happy or sleepy? I don't know necessarily.
All right. Happy especially fades into the background for me because he looks like Doc without the glasses.
They all look like Doc without the glasses, except for Dopey.
They all have the big nose. Yeah.
But yeah, no, I know exactly what you mean. Yeah. Like, I guess, I mean, unless Sleepy's yawning or Sneezy's sneezing or Bashful is turning bright beet red. And like, I don't even know what happy means. Like, he's just smiling.
He's a content fella. I can respect that. He'd probably be the most fun to hang out with out of the group.
Well, probably. I mean, Sneezy will just get snot all over you.
Like destroy our house with his gust of wind.
Sleepy is low maintenance.
Yeah, he'd at least be low-key and chill to hang out with, because he just doze.
Sleepy played the flute in the band, which felt fairly active. So kudos to him for that, at least, taking an active enough role to play an instrument.
Surprised they didn't have a joke where he, like, falls asleep. Like he has to play a triangle, like he's the triangle member, and he has to be at the end. I don't know, you know.
Oh, yeah, wake him up to hit it periodically. I could see that, yeah.
The cliche joke, yeah. Like, why haven't you come?
One of the longest segments in this hangout section is when they're washing their hands before dinner, and it's the seven dwarfs outside, and we just get a lot of little visual gags of them cleaning up. My favorite of the bunch is Dopey with the soap. So first he's like trying to grab the soap, but it's slippery, so it's bouncing around. And then he gets it in his, I don't know if it's the soap itself, but he like swallows it and he's burping up bubbles. That always makes me laugh.
I seem to remember that he got it out at one point, but he never does. So I guess he just digested it eventually.
I really like it when his head disappears. You know, like just the bubble just comes out of his costume and raises his little sock hat above it. That's actually a very funny joke. And I can be down on Snow White, but it does have a lot of fun, gentle humor like that.
Or when Sneezy sneezes and blasts Dopey out of the costume.
Yeah. Or when Dopey keeps circling back and forth to get more forehead kisses. That's cute. It's all good stuff. It's just a lot of it. It's just been a lot of it.
Yeah, I mean, it really does feel like it's more than half the movie.
It's something along the lines of half. I'm pretty positive it's like a good 40 minutes.
The last bit of the hangout section is, I think it's right before they go to bed, they have the jam session. Everybody playing their musical instruments and singing their songs. It's always strange to me to watch how people spent their time in the pre-technology era as like something that movies capture. I always enjoy that. We talked about that when we talked about the rom-com that won Best Picture, Brian, from years ago that we called The Love Bus.
It Happened One Night with Clark Gable.
Okay, yeah. But just how people had to make their own entertainment much more than they do now. And now there's something charming in that. The way that they all could play an instrument, they could all perform together. It's a cool thing. And it's fun. We get a Dopey snapping as he dances. I like.
It's almost unimaginable to think of how people lived like prior to electricity. I find it very difficult. I mean, even though like sometimes the power goes out and I just take naps. I sit there.
Yeah. Yeah. It's like when it gets dark, you go to sleep. That's how the world worked for thousands of years.
Yeah. I mean, I guess people were more tired because of the bat-breaking physical labor as well, but
that too.
And you could read. For most of at least since the 14th century, most upper class people had access to light and reading material. So good for them, I guess. I have no idea what you do if you're a peasant. I guess you do just go to sleep. Procreate. I don't know.
The birth rate was higher for a number of reasons. And when it's time to go to bed, they let Snow White have the entire upper floor to herself, which like, okay, respect for the guests, but like very inefficient. They have 7 beds up there.
I think that might've been a more like a gender segregation thing. Cause you couldn't have them sleep in the same room with her. Not that they're dangerous, obviously, but I just from a code standpoint, a Hays code standpoint. Although they are rendered quite in like sort of like her children anyway. So
that's true, yeah. And so we're like 20 minutes from the end of the movie when we cut back to the main action, the ostensible plot of the film. The evil queen needs to transform herself, and I think we kind of cross cut between it and some of the hangout shenanigans. And I really like the segment where she transforms herself. You get some of the coolest animation in the film. There's a bit like right when she first transforms herself where it seems as if the camera is spinning. I don't even know how they animated that. It's so cool to look at.
Yeah, it's pretty great. I'm guessing some sort of like a pretty long background painting that they then just panned across, but also like warped it a bit. But yeah, it's rad. it's very difficult to see how they pulled it off.
And she has like this crow friend. I really like when she has little evil minion, evil nature friends. So she's got the crow and later she's got the vultures hanging out with her.
Are they hanging out with her?
Yeah, that's a good point.
Are they her friends? I love the vultures. The vultures are like some like maybe my favorite single thing about it because of how they do play with your expectations. That is, oh, they're evil. They're her friends. They're going to follow the villain, the pure evil, the villain. But they're at, you know, foreshadowing of spoiler, the evil queen following, you know,
right,
becoming a bunch of vulture meat.
Right.
or vulture fodder.
And how they turn on her, even though it seems like they should be her friend, you know? Like they don't care when she dies.
Right, they're opportunists. Somebody's gonna die and they're gonna be there.
Somewhere around the transformation, we also see her getting her apple ready, which of course, one of the central Disney symbols, the poison apple. But I had forgotten that we see like a starving skeleton, like just completely rotted away. It's like, this is kind of dark, man.
And it's reaching for a pitcher that's just outside of its its reach. And the witch stops to laugh about that. What a loser.
Yeah, the timeline doesn't match up, but I like to think that's the huntsman. Mm. I like to think that he was allowed to starve to death, even though maybe she wandered in the woods for a much longer time than we think. And his bones have just been picked clean by the rats. Because we never really find out what happened to him. They're like, it might as well be the skeleton.
I couldn't remember if they ever allude to what happens to him. I mean, the obvious inference is that the queen had him killed.
Yeah. I mean, she'd have to, right? I mean, maybe that chalice was actually poison. Never really thought of it that way before, but like, it's right out of reach. He could have dropped it, for he was just poisoned and then that.
Obviously, there's things that happen that we don't see, things beyond the scope. So one can only hope we see the huntsman harvest the pig heart in live action.
Where is Snow White's dad? Where is Snow White's dad? Where is her? Is the evil queen, Queen Regnant? And if so, how? If she's a stepmother?
That's a good point. Maybe he also died. I don't know.
Yeah, but then
wouldn't she be queen? Wouldn't Snow White be queen?
Not typically. I mean, she could be. Like I say, politics can work out even outside of specific succession laws. But you think he's around because no one mentions it, but it doesn't matter. He is in the fairy tales. Like, there is an explanation where the king is and who Snow White's father is, at least in the Grimm version of it. And I would assume most of the folkloric precursors to that, just because it's a question anybody would ask. Where's her dad? Why is the queen running things?
The absent parent, we've talked about some of the things that this, like, precedence that this set for Disney. The absent parent is one for sure. Like, that's obviously a trope of, I mean, I guess fairy tales in general, but very much Disney movies, where at least one of the parents is gone. And we're also going to get another one, the Disney death of the villain. The villain doing something that results in their own death.
Yeah, yeah. At least in Sleeping Beauty, Philip actually like affects a death blow against Maleficent. The Disney death really explodes in the 90s. Or like Beauty and the Beast. Well, sort of in The Rescuers Down Under, although I interpret the imagery as like that little mouse Bernard. He's doing it on purpose. He is tripping a man so that he will fall into crocodiles. But like Beauty and the Beast, Disney death, you know, Gaston just sort of calls his own death.
Tarzan, for sure.
Yeah, and Aladdin doesn't really, but because it's not a death. Like the Clements and Musker movies, the Ron Clements and John Musker movies, actually don't do it, weirdly.
Oh, interesting.
But all of the Truesdale and Wise movies.
Yeah, Frollo.
Yeah, Frollo is like very... You could just kill him. It's fine. Nobody will mind if you just drop him.
No loss to the world. Yeah. Another one I watched this week, actually. But definitely setting a template for like the type of movie that would come. Just the musical fairy tale, I guess. I mean, I guess it's a natural extension of like Merry Melodies and all that. But it is kind of interesting to think about, like, what if they had done a total curveball? Would the type of movies we watch be totally different? I don't know, you know? The type of animated movies that get made.
Well, it may have even been in Hunter's review, but it seems like the reason that it became such a trope is because the princess movie was successful. It's like they did it as their first one. Then they tried some pretty different stuff with Pinocchio and Fantasia and Bambi and Dumbo. Obviously, the war cut into their financial opportunities, but like when they needed something to bring them back, they made another princess movie. In 1950 with Cinderella. And so that really became like their bread and butter because it's what worked.
So when Snow White wakes up the next morning, of course, they need to go to the back to the mine. That's what they do. They dig. And she's going to make lunch. And I was laughing. They're like, now don't let anyone in the house, Snow White. Whatever you do, don't let anyone in the house. And it had me thinking of The Simpsons when Marge says, Homer, don't you eat this pie. It's like the one thing you know is going to happen like 10 seconds after the dwarf leaves or Marge leaves the room. And sure enough, the dwarfs leave and immediately the queen, now transformed into an old hag, shows up.
I thought it was funny early on in the movie when the dwarves first come home and see that Snow White is there. Grumpy says, well, you can't stay here. You're going to bring down the wrath of the queen. And Snow White's excuse is like, no, I won't. She won't find me.
So if only she had some sort of magical apparatus that can give her knowledge. That would tell her whatever she needs to know.
Find her the next day.
But we get some cool segments here. So at first, like the friendly animals are fighting off the old hag queen. And then Snow White lets the hag into the house. What is she at this point? We just call her still the queen, I guess.
Yeah.
And lets the queen into the house. And then we get this really cool cross-cutting section where the animals are trying to frantically let the dwarfs know that the queen came exactly as Grumpy predicted would happen. And Snow White, like, taking her time talking to the queen and getting offered an apple and, like, debating which flavor pie she's going to make for the dwarfs. But, of course, she bites the apple before the dwarfs get there, just a moment before. And I always like the way that it's shown, where we just see her, like, hand and the apple with one bite rolling out of her hand. It's kind of like it's got a dramatic flair to it, and it's kind of doing more by showing less, I think.
Yeah, they focus on the queen and like her moment of triumph.
Mm-hmm.
Her heart will still and her blood congeal and et cetera, et cetera. She's very happy about it. She's ecstatic.
Right.
There's more rhyming in the dialogue than I remembered.
Yeah, I like that about it.
Like, there's parts where it's not singing, but it's still in verse.
Now, I didn't look it up. Is it the same voice actor pre-transformation and post-transformation for the queen?
Apparently it is. I did look that up.
It's good. She has very distinct and memorable voices for both.
Which I wish she didn't. I wish there was actually less distinction between the two. I don't understand why there is.
Oh, like tie her together a little bit more? Yeah.
Yeah. Very regal thing to say.
Well, that to me really shows that, like, evil corrupts. You know, it's that, like, she's sacrificing the thing that she ostensibly cares the most about, which is her beauty, to seek vengeance. Like, that drive is destroying her.
Yeah. All right, yeah, and she loses her class, too. That actually makes sense. I like it.
Yeah, we were ragging on the queen and her strategy earlier, but just like Hunter was saying, there's a certain essentialism if you're doing a fairy tale. I think that's true with the queen, too. It's like, you got to accept that she's like a symbol of the danger of like grasping to youth that won't fade and leaning into your evil impulses and selfish impulses rather than accepting the things around you and all that. But yeah.
She's Jenna Maroney.
But the dwarfs chase the queen off and the queen kind of goes up this cliff that's nearby. Oh, it started raining. I always like when it starts, the weather gets bad at dramatic moments. I love that trope. And she goes up, like, it's a cliff that's nearby, which we do see, like, mountains and cliffs as they're walking home and stuff. So it makes sense that it would be there. And she has this idea to, like, pry this boulder and roll it down a hill to get the dwarfs. But as she's doing it, it, like, looses the cliff and she plummets to her own death. Which we hear her scream. We don't see her fall at all. The boulder falls down too. So if the fall didn't finish her, the boulder is going to do the job. I like how the vultures get really happy when she falls. It's a very nice touch. And then they immediately swoop down after her. And it gets kind of gauzy and fade out. It's really, really nifty. A little bit of design, animation, I guess. I don't know quite how they achieve this effect. It's like you can almost put like gauze up on the camera to make it.
Yeah, or Vaseline on the lens or something.
Yeah. And then we have the ending. The dwarfs are so smitten by her deathly beauty, that they refuse to bury her. They keep a vigil.
On the one hand, that's kind of creepy. But on the other hand, Snow White is lucky. Like, if she wasn't so beautiful in death, I guess they would have just buried her alive.
Yeah, what is the deal with the sleeping death state? I don't quite know what that is.
Well, also, the queen really didn't look into the fine print of her spell. Didn't even turn that other page.
It's like, oh, she could have read one more page and been like, oh, maybe I should think about a different technique to finish Snow White. Because this one, all she has to do is get a kiss. But yeah.
Could have just used regular science poison.
Yeah. Why do you got to be magic potion? There's lots of poisons out there. You can just get it. You're a queen. You can probably get your hands on one. But of course, the prince that we met at the beginning of the movie comes by, gives her a kiss, and she wakes up and takes her to a shining castle in the distance. And the dwarfs are happy for her. And that's the happily ever after. I like the shining castle in the distance. I feel like you sometimes would see these paintings of like angelic happily ever afters. I feel like Birth of a Nation has one at the end of it I was thinking of too. Obviously that one, the context is very different, as we talked about last week, Brian, or 2 weeks ago. But that's how Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs ends. And we get a frame of the storybook, the same one that had the opening text with, and they lived happily ever after, of course. So what are some things, some observations or moments or something that we haven't talked about yet that you guys like or don't like or noticed?
When did the transition happen between the movies where you would have all the opening credits at the start and you'd usually have some kind of book or something, some central object that you're lingering on as the opening credits are playing and you get some specific opening song?
I know they had it with Sleepy Hollow. That one still had it.
Oh, yeah. Easily through the 50s. Alice has it. Peter Pan has it. Did it stop with, like, 101 Dalmatians? I'm not sure. I mean, I've heard so many times that Star Wars is the one that changed the paradigm of you don't put your credits at the start anymore. You put them at the end. But I wonder when it happened with Disney.
I'm trying to think what the last one was. Definitely Robin Hood has credits at the start, fairly full credits at the start. It may also have end credits.
Oh, right. Yeah, you have the hamster dance at the start.
Yeah. Yeah, whistle stop. I don't know. Maybe. Oh, you know what? Fox and the Hound doesn't. Fox and the Hound, I'm pretty sure, or at least at the very least, it has like a narrative action scene going on. If it doesn't, I believe it doesn't even have text, but I could be wrong about that. And that's 1981.
I think you could be right, because like Rescuers, I think, has something that happens and then the credits play like as the message is going out to sea.
That's it. Rescuers. Yeah. In 77. Yeah. They have an opening credit sequence,
which was the same year as Star Wars. You know, people were getting adventurous with credits. But then Wish brought it back as a little tribute, is have the book at the start. And of course, Shrek has the book at the start,
which he uses as toilet paper. My daughters know that if you see the credits at the beginning of a film, that means it's an old movie, which is, doesn't hold 100% of the time, but pretty close to it.
Pretty close.
Like my 6-year-old will be like, oh, we're watching an old movie today. I was like, yeah, good eye, good memory.
Yeah, if you just see a card and hear a chorus, just sort of indistinctly wailing, definitely an old movie. They should bring it back.
So we still have a top five to do. So I think we can hop into, is it good? Is there anything else anyone else wants to throw out there before we do?
The general observation that I do enjoy the sort of dreaminess of early Disney fairy tales. Not in all cases and in all ways, but the sort of, even though it can lead to like sort of narrative dead ending, I do like the general vibe. Like we are actually trying to do a fairy tale. We're actually trying to do mythic time vibe that you get from even through the Silver Age, even in, up through like Sleeping Beauty, and you get it back occasionally with like the Little Mermaid. Yeah, but you get it even in like modern stuff, but it is like much more self-aware about it. is very more self-conscious about it. And this seems, if it is self-conscious, which it probably is, I mean, the 30s are still pretty modern. It hides it better, I guess.
That's a good point. Yeah.
And it assumes a patience in the audience that you might not today.
That is part of the appeal of the Golden Age Disney stuff, is that mythic quality that I think you certainly don't get in the same way in the CGI era and intermittently in between. Like, you're not getting too much mythic in 101 Dalmatians, for example. But I will talk us into Is It Good? So Is It Good is our signature section where we each give the movie a rating on our 8-point goodness scale, ranging from very not good, which is 1 out of 8, to our masterpiece rating, toward a good, which is an 8 out of 8. Now, Hunter, you should at least know the rating scale a little bit from my site.
I do.
And if not, you can just think of it as 4 stars with half stars in between. So
I'm going to get a calculator out and just, it should
if
be.
If you think I haven't done that, I have spreadsheets converting between different rating systems. So
6.142.
So, Brian, why don't you go first? Is Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs good?
Okay. So, something I noticed in my big watch through is our opinions of the movies are probably going to be colored by when we watch them. So, did we watch them when we were children? In which case, they probably have a stronger hold on our memories and our sentiments. This was one that I watched really early on. And also, it's the first one that came out. So maybe part of this rating is influenced by its historical role and just how much of a new accomplishment it was. I'm going to give it a 7 out of 8, just into 7 territory. And that's bolstered by some of the things I noticed this time, like how impressive the coloring is and the lighting. And I'm not the biggest fan of the rotoscoping on the human characters, but broadly, I like the music. I like the structure, even doesn't bother me, that we hang out with the dwarves, because just about every set piece has something interesting going on. And it's toward the upper end. I did go through, just to keep track of all the movies, because we're going to have a top 5 here in a second, and I assigned a rating to everything to kind of keep them straight. And this is definitely in the higher end. What about you guys?
Hunter, why don't you answer next? Is Snow White good?
It is good. It is good. Yeah, I guess 6 out of 8. I guess I'll go for that. Sounds low.
We call that very good. Yeah.
Oh, all right. Well, that, yeah, I guess that is. Yeah, all right. Very good. And yes, 6. I'm happy with a 6 out of 8. I liked it more when I was a child in the 1930s, and it was very new. But yeah, it's one of those movies where if I really make an effort to like think of it in its historical context in 1937, then it is mind-blowing. But I don't live in 1937. I live in 2024. And I have seen things that have built upon it since. And so I can't really just throw those out. And I don't want to reward it just because of industrial importance or artistic influence. However, it is still like a really fun, very easy movie to watch. I've probably seen it, you know, 5-6 times, something like that. And I'll probably see it a few more times. Yeah, very good.
So I'm like right there between you two guys. There's not a 6.5. I'm going to be a soft 7 rather than a strong 6, because I'm right around there. And pretty much exactly what you guys said. I mean, it really does go down easy for a movie this old. It's entertaining the whole time through. The structure is a little ragged. It would bother me a little bit that like you're waiting for something to happen. But like Brian said, there's fun stuff going the whole time. The animation is just so impressive. And it really is remarkable how good classic animation still looks. Like early CGI doesn't look good. Good classic animation, hand-drawn, always looks good and always will look good. So, you know, I think it's just a treat to watch. And some of the character designs and animation are so good. Some of the like effects and framing of all the action, terrific. And everything you guys said about colors and lights and stuff. And just the mythic quality to it. It endures. It speaks. Because it is mythic, it will always speak to whoever's watching it, even with some of the antiquated stuff that we've talked about. So exceptionally good for me as well, but a soft exceptionally good, because as a narrative, it just, and the character doesn't, the character of Snow White, those things just don't pull me in quite as much as some of the better Disney movies. But it's still a great one. And tune in soon for part two, our top five Walt Disney Animation Studio films coming soon.